This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
Podcasting purposes. Good evening and welcome to another one of our series on entitled Like a Prayer, Popular Music and Religious Identity. Tonight we are shifting gears and we will be hearing from Juan Floyd Thomas, who is going to be speaking to us. What exactly is the title again?
It's Like God is Testing Me.
It's Like God is Testing Me. This would be approaches to the study of rap music, and we're really looking forward to hearing this. Let me say a few words about Juan. Professor Floyd Thomas received his BA from Rutgers University, his MA from Temple University, and his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, all in the field of history. Before coming to Vanderbilt this semester, he has taught in the history departments at both Virginia Tech and Texas Christian University, respectively. His research interests include religious pluralism within modern American society, race, ethnicity, and religion in U.S. history, and interdisciplinary approaches to the academic study of religious thought, especially cultural, political, economic, and social scientific theories and methods for analyzing the African-American Christian experience. In his teaching and research, Floyd Thomas emphasizes issues such as media interpretations and cultural images of African-American religion, the varieties of African-American religious experience, African-American churches and socio-political reform, as well as the intersections of popular culture and American Christianity in the 20th century. In addition to several journal articles and book chapters, one of which we read for this evening's session, at least my students did, he is author of The Origins of Black Humanism, Reverend Ethelred Brown and the Unitarian Church, and co-author of Black Church Studies and Introduction. As well as several articles and book chapters, he is currently working on four major research projects: A City Called Heaven, A History of African American Religion in Harlem; Blessed Assurance, A Narrative History of Black Church in America; The Altars Where We Worship, The Religious Significance of American Popular Culture, to be co-authored with Stacy Floyd Thomas and Mark Toulouse; and Making It Plain, Approaches in African-American Religious History, to be co-authored with A.G. Miller. In addition, he is co-editor of the Making It Plain Approaches in Black Church Studies series with Abingdon Press. Professor Floyd Thomas is also a co-founder and executive board member of the Black Religious Scholars Group and currently serves on the cultural resources team of the African-American Lectionary. And for today's session, our class in popular music and religious identity has read a chapter of his in this book by Anthony, edited by Anthony Penn. That chapter is entitled A Jihad of Words: The Evolution of African American Islam and Contemporary Hip Hop Music. Please make welcome for tonight our guest speaker, Juan Floyd Thomas.
Thank you all for coming out, especially given all the events and concerns that plague us and titillate us today, as far as us being in proximity, the epicenter, as I like to say, of the political universe. I want to thank you all for taking some time out, and I hope that some of the comments and conversations we have this evening will be fruitful. Also, while I have the chance and not to expend too much time, I want to thank my good friend and colleague, Professor McClure, for inviting me to share some thoughts and hopefully some insights on the topic of faith and hip-hop and how I see the intersections of both. Having said that, I've been stopped on a few occasions when people have heard or seen the title of this presentation and they stop to ask me, what's wrong? Are you okay? And what I would suggest is that, first of all, these words are not mine, but I borrowed these words that make up the title of this paper from a lyricist that I have found great solace and comfort in his words, a rapper by the name of Common Sense on a song, Act Two, Love of My Life, which he performs on in conjunction with The Roots. He offers the following words, and I just want to repeat them. I wanted to play the full track, but for the sake of time, I'll move this way. As of late, I realize that this is her fate, referring to hip-hop and talking about the great love that he has for the art form and the culture that comprises what we know of as hip-hop. And we'll discuss this in a minute. As of late, I realize this is her fate or destiny that brings the best of me. It's like God is testing me. In retrospect, I see that she brought life and death to me. Peace to us collectively, live and direct when we perform. It's just coffee shop chicks and white dudes. Over her, I got into it with Ice Cube. Now the fight has moved on into life, making the right moves. Besides God and family, you're my life's jewel. Now, as a member of the hip-hop generation, I'm thrown into a particularly tricky situation as a veritable insider-outsider in a concerted effort to analyze this cultural form that we are now discussing, both as a researcher and a person of faith. Whereas none of these are mutually exclusive concerns, these are the kind of issues that have to be addressed when doing research of this sort. First and foremost, defining my own identity in juxtaposition to the cultural and or subcultural reality. Second, the study of popular culture can often be seen as a paradox to researchers unto itself for a variety of reasons. Culture, whether we're talking in terms of high or low culture, is often understood as a moving target that is hard to pin down with any precise fashion. Moreover, once it has been captured in some absolute sense, the organic and dynamic nature of culture in question becomes frozen in a state of suspended animation. Also, by definition, the notion of popular culture implies its antithesis, unpopular culture. Much like how the term conscious rap would often suggest that there is actually a form of music we can now refer to as unconscious rap. How does one discern those real divisions without being derisive of the distinctions that practitioners still find meaningful and potent about a mode of cultural expression in which you can personally still have interest? Meanwhile, while with each passing day, I'm finding myself caught very much in the creeping fog of what I affectionately refer to as the curmudgeon factor. As an aging member of the hip-hop generation who even now is forced to ask the question, am I getting too old for hip-hop, or with all of its sub-genres and subdivisions such as crunk, chopped and screwed, ringtone rap, etc., is the music simply getting worse? Taking all these questions and more into consideration, I think that the lyrics shared by Common offer some insights about hip-hop music in ways that illustrate, at its best, its confessional and cosmological concerns. Now, I'll briefly outline some issues that first lead us to think about what is hip-hop as a culture or an art form. And as we see here on the screen, there are five elements in and of themselves that help us get into what hip-hop is. And for any social researcher or anybody who's even casually interested in trying to figure out what's going on with an art form or a subculture, you have to figure out the way in. All right. For me, and I believe this stands pretty much as a standard issue, the MC, the lyricist, the rapper, the person who, as one rapper refers to it, creates this rhythmic African-American poetry or rap, the DJ, the person who's creating the musical or sonic backdrop for the music to be performed and for the excitement and anticipation to build. The dance. Now, when hip-hop began, it was breakdancing, but now there have been so many variations on that theme that I simply try to frame it in the term of dance. Next, graffiti. Now, here in this space, you know, and I'm grateful for the choice of artwork and decor that was brought in, to let you know and to understand this kind of outsider art and the fact that by reclaiming space, not only lyrically or musically or physically through kinetic motion, but also through the graphic display of pictures on walls, yeah, much like ancient ancestors in ancient Greece or ancient Egypt, use their hieroglyphs or other kind of iconic illustrations to let the world know that we are here, we exist. And then last but not least, a sense of fashion and a sense of an aesthetic that somehow lends itself to a greater understanding and appreciation that we claim this space. Now, how this works in a kind of gestalt sense, or kind of altogether some of its parts, is this aesthetic, the taking of something as simple as a polo shirt, a pair of sunglasses, and blue jeans, but rearranging them, or as you would say in within the culture itself, you know, flipping them in such a way so that they now have a distinctive mark that only you or only someone who understands how you live or where you're coming from can identify with you, an in-group versus out-group kind of distinction. Okay. Now, if this will do what it's supposed to do, yes. Going deeper into how we can now assess a greater sense of, once we have the elements in play, how can you start to analyze and critique and investigate hip-hop in its deeper meanings? Oh, that was not supposed to happen. One moment, please. Yes. I believe it begins with the act of excavation. How one unearths the potential in the past, or using the vocabulary of hip-hop heads, digging in the crates, whether it's trying to find musical selections that would somehow match what you have in your head, what you're imagining and hoping to produce for the world's enjoyment, education, or entertainment, whether it's the idea of, and I think this is one of the most fascinating examples of this, a rapper by the name of J. Ruta Damager from New York, he and the DJ Premier, created a song called Come Clean. The reason why I'm so impressed by this song is, as its backing musical track, Premier uses the sound of water dropping from a leaky faucet in order to create a rhythm track. Now, some people would refer to that or think to that as a mild form of torture, but in this realm of imagination, creating a sound that's quite organic, albeit troubling, but turning it into something that has creative possibilities that no one previously imagined. Right? In that and other ways, this notion of excavation is very crucial to the art and the culture of hip-hop. Next, the expository. How one tells the story, right? In other words, you know, for many rappers or people in the know, it would be referred to as spitting game, right? Coming from a long tradition of folk tales and folk art, how do you render the story in such a way that keeps people's attention, grabs them, doesn't let them go, or leads them down any myriad of paths that you're trying to get them to follow? Next, the experiential, how one lives in the moment, or in other words, keeps it real. So much of what passes for and what qualifies as authenticity, and in many regards, as we'll talk about later, the issue that for the sake of authenticity, the increasing levels of violence, the increasing levels of mutual disrespect or you know, other forms of oppressive behavior creep in. But nevertheless, trying to talk about the world as you see it, how you live in it, and ultimately what you want to make of it, that becomes a very crucial dimension of what we're undertaking. Next, the exegetical. How one reads the situation quite literally, right? Breaks it down, right? This becomes such a vital part of how hip-hop, at least in its formative period, and I think it still has the potential to do so even in our time, but how it's been able to become not just a local or even a regional phenomenon, but a global phenomenon. The fact that, and I've had the opportunity to travel as far as Japan, as far as Israel, and find rap groups there, indigenous rap groups, not just African-American transplants, but Jewish and Palestinian rappers in the heart of Israel. You know, the Harikou kids in the heart of Tokyo who also love rhyming. So the idea that this thing can be so far expanded and so far extended across the map because folks feel that they can tap into it and it can be part of their world. Last but not least, the experimental, how one renews the art and culture, or in other words, flips the script. This too becomes a very vital and important part of the investigation of the form because, as many folks have hoped in the beginning of rap, that it would disappear and die. But then even some of the practitioners themselves, most notably and recently a fellow by the name of Nas, actually proclaiming that hip-hop is dead, right? How will this cultural form keep itself alive from one iteration to the next, right? And I would also add the idea that if it doesn't reach out beyond itself, not just in consumer base or listeners and clients, but also in terms of how it embraces new experiences, new cultures, new ideas, that too will lead it to surely die. The reason I make this point, and what fascinates me most about this, is that much like the physical body needs food for sustenance, right, the mind also, the spirit also needs food for thought, constant renewal and refreshing, or it too will wither and fade away. So what I would say, and this goes back to my little curmudgeon concern, when I listen to a lot of what passes for hip-hop nowadays, it's become virtually cannibalistic. It's not broadening the circle or embracing newer or bigger things than, you know, what the last hit record was. And so repeating a lot of what's popular and not trying to break new ground. Now, as we can talk, especially in the Q&A, there's plenty of still exciting and interesting hip-hop out there. I'm still waiting for the next Outkast album. I'm still waiting for so much that's about the new Common album. I'm feverishly waiting. But thinking about how constantly looking inward actually is a suicidal affair without the prospect or the regard for looking outward. Okay. Now, turning our focus to this piece that I'm glad you've had, hopefully those of you in the class have had a chance to read, Jihad of Words. When I came to this project and thinking about how to approach it and how to structure my attention to this issue of the African-American influences in hip-hop, I was struck by one major concern that eventually mushroomed into several. First, how do you take something as broad, as general, as wide open as Black Muslim influences in hip-hop music and actually get your arms around it? Okay. Well, in part, what I've tried to do, and as you'll see, I'm sorry about that. As I've tried to do, is try to break it down into a typology of three parts. Matching my training as a historian and where I'm flowing from that perspective, I already understood, I'm looking at the post-war era, I'm looking at roughly a 30 to 40 year period. So that was safe, that was fairly contained. But more importantly, trying to map out and figure out exactly what made African-American Islam such an overwhelming factor in this development, in this evolution of hip-hop as an art form. One of the things that I realized, and in conversation with Dr. Penn, who was, as Dr. McClure has mentioned, the editor of this project, I was exceedingly glad that I had the task of taking on African-American Islam and hip-hop, both because it was a field of study that I was already immersed in and familiar with, but also, sadly to say, and I did not envy my colleague Garth Baker Fletcher in this, I was grateful that I didn't have to deal with Black Christian rap because to my taste and to my liking, it was abominable. It was hard to listen to. I couldn't get into it. And even that which at the time could be listened to was really a cultural dead end. Why I'm bringing this up is not to cast aspersion or overly critique the form, but hip-hop, unlike so many other musical forms that came before it, talking about the kind of great work that James Cone did in analyzing the spirituals and the blues. Before him, Howard Thurman talking about Deep River and the Negro speaks of life and death. Even before him, W.B. Du Bois in the last chapter of Souls of Black Folk dealing with the sorrow songs, those old Negro spirituals, and wrestling and wringing out all the meaning and importance of those cultural forms for not only Black America, but for all Americans. Right? There had been impressive work making connections of how at the root of Black popular culture and music, gospel music, spirituals had been a rudiment or a foundation of those. But hip-hop was different and unique in my opinion, in my purview, by virtue of the fact that unlike the blues, unlike jazz, unlike rock and roll, unlike R&B, funk, soul, what have you, hip-hop was actually a multi-dimensional, polyglot kind of music, that it was taking in everything that was around it. If you want to put it in these kind of terms, it was the first postmodern form. You know, some of those folks who wrestle with postmodernist theory would refer to it as bricolage, a patchwork or a mosaic, right? Taking bits from Jamaican reggae and ska, taking bits from, you know, country and western, taking little bits from, you know, anything that was available and readily usable. So what we have to deal with here is, it's not automatically, hip-hop music is not automatically dependent or beholden to its roots in gospel and the spirituals. So now how do you get a way in once again? Well, for me, I figured to work from the opposite side and think about, okay, well, if I'm starting to notice or starting to see that there was this trend in which folks are starting to mention various forms of Islam within hip-hop. And as we'll begin, some of the most ardent and I think most impressive displays of early hip-hop had to do with members of various breakaway groupings of Islam, such as the Nation of Islam, the Five Percenters, and others. But I was also seeing that chronologically as well as sociologically, that they were falling into distinct patterns as well. And that kind of typology is what we're going to deal with tonight. First, those artists or those lyricists who are referring to religion as ideological, okay, who are wrestling with it as a force for social change and radical politics. Next, and this largely falls within the province and domain of the Five Percenters, those who viewed religion as instrumental, as a way of maintaining or fixing their life and their circumstances in ways that weren't normally or readily available to them. And finally, religion as integral. The Sunni Muslims or more traditional or orthodox practitioners of Islam who happen to be African American, and how they were finding meaning and spiritual regard by reconnecting to a larger sense of what faith could be. Now, all of this is undergirded by a sense of what's going on in terms of what do we mean by Black? What do we mean by faith? First and foremost, what I would suggest or put forward for your consideration is that when we talk about race, especially in terms of Blackness, you know, I have full understanding and awareness, thanks to thoughtful contributions by critical race theorists or philosophers of race or even scientists who, you know, through the wonders of the Human Genome Project, are denouncing or having us rethink our pre-existing notions about race and, by extension, trying to help us overcome in many ways our attachment to racial prejudice, racism writ large. But having said that, there's still, I believe, especially as a historian, very fundamental social conditions, very fundamental historical circumstances that we as a society, as a human brother and sisterhood have to engage in order to better understand what's going on with terms of race. And also, above and beyond that, in seeing that heritage or seeing that distinct sort of reality, have to now more directly deal with the notion that without being essentialist or overgeneralizing, that there is something known as a black identity and that it does have a very unique and sometimes very tangible reality to it. Okay, and many of these artists are wrestling with that understanding of what does it mean to be black. Second, and I think most importantly for our conversation tonight, the idea of faith. I come at this idea of faith from a place where, greatly informed by the work of C. Eric Lincoln and Lawrence Mamiya, dealing with this notion of black sacred cosmos in addressing a worldview that is very much all a part of how African Americans are dealing with the world around them, how they're proceeding and pursuing their social agendas, as well as listening and sharing liberation messages. Taking this one step further, the idea that freedom, justice, and equality have to be central to anything that's going to be positive or redeeming within the culture and the larger art forms that spin out from it. Lastly, but certainly not least, my notion of faith was greatly shaped by, among other folks, the theologian of culture, Paul Tillich. When he talks about the issue of faith as ultimate concern, this typology that we're looking at now is very much deeply wedded to this idea of trying to get at what these rappers are talking about when they're referring to faith, or whether the entire song is embedded and wrestling with notions of faith, or they're just saying it in passing. How are they trying to wrestle with the idea of the divine, or how are they trying to wrestle with notions of sin, redemption? How are they trying to deal with these kind of concerns about theological anthropology? You know, why are we here? Why were we made this way? What should we do with issues of love or death? And ultimately, how, by expressing these concerns, are we better able to understand where they're coming from and possibly where we're going? Now, I just want to switch gears and get us to the heart of the matter for this evening, which is share some of the songs off the playlist in the hopes that we can jumpstart a conversation. Thank you. All right. And don't say one moment, please. Now, the first song on the playlist for this evening is a song from roughly 1988 by the group Public Enemy. For those of y'all who were not enrolled in the class or might not have looked at this previously, it's a song, quite simply, Bring the Noise. And if it will start... Ah, that's the problem, okay. Now,
Bass, how low can you go? Death row? What a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the incredible D. Public Enemy number one. 5-4 say freeze, and I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun? But it's the wax that determined the X-Bun. Now they got me in a cell, took my records they sell. Cause a brother like me said, well, Farrakhan's a prophet, and I think you want to listen to what he can say to you. What you ought to do is follow for now. Hell, what the people say, make a miracle, D. I'm the lyrical, black is black, all in, we're gonna win, check it out. Here we go again. Bring the noise.
Now, in wrestling with this piece, the first and foremost thing for anyone who may or may not be familiar with Public Enemy and its history, the idea that they were trying to reignite a sense of black power politics and radicalism in the heart of the Reagan and Bush one political era of conservatism. So this idea that everything from their style of dress to the kind of loud and aggressive tone of the music, which in and of itself was a sonic collage. What they were trying to do is trying to shock people, rock and shock the nation. Well, in part, what I've come to appreciate or embrace about this and how I think it falls into that first type, religion as ideological, is this idea that by that very quick but very well-placed mention of the minister Louis Farrakhan, they're trying to evoke a sense of radicalism that, as many folks would see this as a form of signification, they're trying to say, all right, we are super black because we listen to Farrakhan, and we listen to Farrakhan because Farrakhan's a prophet that I think you better listen to. This idea that if you're not with our agenda, then you would refuse to listen to the minister, and more likely, I know all about you because of that one simple gesture. Now, what becomes tricky in this sense, as far as looking at other groups that fall into this bailiwick, KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions, X-Clan, other groups, is this idea that there's a very rigid core that happens when you have this kind of religion as ideological in play, which is, if it's strictly ideology, if it's strictly bound to politics and a sort of checking off a shopping list of are you with us or against us kind of sensibilities, well, can I appreciate or embrace the music as, you know, a born-again, you know, blood-bought Christian and still have some place within the kind of sphere that you're creating here? Can we have some common ground even if, you know, this one issue isn't mine, that I don't take it up? Something else that I think becomes important about groups like Public Enemy and others, by clinging so firmly, so fiercely to this sense of religion as ideological, when a historic shift occurred, for some folks, y'all might not have noticed it, but there was a slight transition within the world of hip-hop where more Afrocentric, more black nationalist, more conscious forms of the music were eclipsed, were in a decline or descendancy, whereas right around the early 1990s, you start to see the ascendancy of a form that became very prevalent and almost ubiquitous, known as gangster rap, right? So with the decline of more conscious, more politically engaged, if not always thoroughly thought out hip-hop, you now have a more nihilistic, a more devastating form of the culture cropping up. Well, from my view, I also see that this was accompanied both based on just the general shifts of people and culture, but also given the kind of market demands that were also, I think, at play at this time. You see the axis of interest or power going from the East Coast to the West Coast, and so now the East Coast is trying to respond to this, how best to respond, but suddenly shifting its focus to what I'm referring to as the five percenters, or this notion of religion as, now instrumental. And I think the best example of this, and I'm hoping that this will go forward, right around the same time the Public Enemy was unveiling its kind of political agenda set to music, another group by the name of Eric B. and Rakim were offering a completely different perspective on the world of hip-hop music.
This is a journey into sound.
Now, I'm going to try and speed through this for the sake of time, but part of what we have here in terms of this song, it's not even really a song. If you think about it, it totally defies verse, chorus, verse kind of structure. And yet, if you play this song in many clubs or many dance floors, you know, anywhere, it elicits an automatic response. The way that this one song sparked and opened many people's imaginations about the possibilities of hip-hop. Also, just to quickly add here, the singer that you're now listening to is a woman by the name of Ofra Haza. She's since passed away. But obviously, Eric B. and Rakim, although they're five percenters at the time, didn't speak Arabic, had no real understanding of Middle Eastern music, but they liked the sound. Right. Now, whether it's, you know, harkening back to a kind of Orientalism and exoticism that, you know, Edward Said were referred to, what we're ultimately dealing with here is them trying to build a bridge between East and West. But now I'm going to be quiet and let Rakim speak.
Thinking of a master plan. This ain't nothing but sweat inside my hand. So I dig into my pocket, all my money spent. So I get default. Still coming up with lint. So I start my mission, leave my residence. Thinking how could I get some dead presidents? I need money. I used to be a stick up kid. So I think of all the devious things I did. I used to roll up. This is a hole up. Ain't nothing funny. Stop smiling. Still don't nothing move but the money. But now I learn to earn because I'm righteous. I feel great, so maybe I might just search for a 9 to 5. If I strive, then maybe I stay alive. So I walk up the street, whistling this, feeling that placeless man who I miss. A pen and a paper, a stereo, a taper. Me and Eric being a nice big plate of this, which is my favorite dish. But without the money, it's still a wish. Cause I don't like to dream about getting paid. So I dig into the books of the rhymes that I made. Tune out to test to see if I got cool. Hit the studio, cause I'm paid full.
And with that verse, sparks a whole new revolution within the genre of hip-hop. Now, I think that this is important for several reasons. First and foremost, that pivotal line in the middle of the song when Rakim is talking about being righteous, that previously, prior to that moment that he had, as the 5%ers would refer to it, as knowledge of self, you know, came to a greater level of racial pride, self-awareness, he was a criminal. He had a scandalous way of living, and he would do anything, you know, to borrow the famous phrase by Malcolm X, you know, he would seek money by any means necessary. But then the transition, that point of rupture in his own personal history, when he became righteous, now he's learned to earn. Now maybe he'll get a job. Maybe he can strive and stay alive. Now, as we look at the larger trajectory of this notion of religion as instrumental, there are very key and I think crucial factors that have to be addressed. With many of the songs that fall in this category, and for the sake of time, I'll move past playing some of these, but with many of the songs by Nas and so forth, when they lay out this outline of what the Nation of Islam contributed to the 5%ers, you have the creation of a mythology about how the origin of humanity began. You know, the creation of black people as the original man, and they use that very specifically in a masculinist sense. The notion of whiteness and white people being connoted as the devil, right? Blue-eyed devils. This is once again a carryover from the Nation of Islam. The idea that language in and of itself was malleable enough so that if you wanted to express who and what you were and what you believed and what you're about, right, you can offer it up in, some folks would call it street slang, but it was a form of witty poetry or verbal dexterity. So instead of just talking about all the gadgets that we are now too invested in or too rooted in, right, as technology, they would refer to it as tricknology. Right, in regards to certain issues as far as when they wanted to try and excite and try to enlighten people, they would try to talk about dropping the bomb on somebody, but not in a literal or violent sense, but simply saying that in order to get through to some people, you need that kind of concussive force, that kind of shock. Some of these thoughts flowed straight from the Nation of Islam into the 5%ers uninterrogated, unwrestled with, i.e. the embodiment of the devil, you know, a notion of black supremacy, the kind of ideas about what actually entails redemption or what actually is involved in what's sinful. If Eric B. and Rakim are talking about the issue that robbing folks or hustling is still an option, but I choose not. Okay, we all understand that, but at its core, what we see happening in terms of trying to live life in a way so that we can transcend our frailties and faults as human beings, what becomes interesting within this notion of religion as instrumental is that, quite literally, it takes a cynical and very fixed view of humanity, saying that it's very hard, nearly impossible, to transcend your brokenness. All right. So what happens now when, to borrow a line from Nas, he reflects on the idea that he had just turned 20 years old, and you know, in his neighborhood, 20 is approaching AARP status. So now he's thinking, wow, I'm glad I made it. And maybe today, instead of robbing somebody, a foreigner, for their green card, right, maybe the dollar that I would take to the liquor store and buy a bottle of malt liquor, maybe I can win the lotto. Right? So trading, you know, one kind of bad situation for a slightly better but no more progressive situation. So what we're wrestling with in those terms are trying to face different life chances through religion, but not necessarily expanding beyond the constraints of what I'd like to advance is a ghetto-centric kind of mentality. Okay. Last but not least, I'd like to move us forward to another sample and then open up some time for conversation. And hopefully if I can get a hold of this. Okay. We'll go ahead with this. The last example of religion as now talking about in terms of an integral force, not only for the author, the artist, but also for the audience.
Another line, ticket line, he led. Began with time. Being my bloodline is one with the divine in time, brother. You will discover the light. Some say the God is black and the devil's white. Well, the devil is wrong and God is what's right. I fight with myself in the ring of doubt and fear. The rain ain't gone, but I can still see clear. As a child, given religion with no answer to why. Just hope, believe in Jesus, cause for me he did die. Curiosity kill the catechism, understanding and wisdom became the rhythm that I played to and became a slave to master self. A rich man is one with knowledge, happiness, and his health. My mind had dealt with the books as in, tale the lessons, Quran and the Bible. To me, they all vital and got truth within them. Gotta read them, boys. You just can't skim them. Different branches of belief, but one with that stem them. But people of the venom try to trim them. And use religion as an emblem when it's to be a natural way of life. Who am I or they to say to whom you praying, right? That's who got you doing right and got you this far. Whether you say in Jesus' name or Alhamdulillah, long as you know it's a being that's supreme to you. You let that show towards others and the things you do. Cause when the trumpet's blowing, 24 elders surround the throne. Only 144,000 gon' get home. Only 144,000 gon' get home. Only 144,000 gon' get it, baby.
From the title of the song, Gaining One's Definition, God, as an acronym, to this idea that common, and this also features another artist, CeeLo, formerly of Goody Mob and Gnarls Barkley and several other projects. He's trying to render a sense, you know, whether he's offering this kind of ecumenical vision of what faith is, could be, should be, or also, as the entire album is wrestling with his kind of personal journey as a young man, as he expresses early on, of 25, trying to go through this world and make sense of what's going on around him. Just to preface it, you know, the rapper's name, Common, short for Common Sense. The album itself was One Day It'll All Make Sense, so it's a play on words, so just go with me here. But what's most important about the album within his own personal journey is the fact that it follows the murder of a good friend, a lifelong friend of his, and so in his kind of reflective process, you know, I won't call it a concept album, you know, we can talk about that shortly, but he's trying to take a journey through all the kind of transitions and phases of life of which he sees religion being a central part, right? Now, for him, in his own kind of personal regard, he's been dealing with not only the loss of a friend, the impending birth of a child, as he mentions also in the song, relationship problems, which maybe too many of us can relate to, but just all these kind of facets and aspects of a human life that for a hip-hop album circa the late 90s, you weren't bound to often hear, right? In a music industry that was far too inundated with issues of sex, violence, materialism, and the like, to have somebody actually want to be complicated rather than just plain hard was something fascinating. Now, what goes along with this in this issue of trying to look at religion as integral, he, as well as other artists, you know, whether they're actually Muslims or simply pro-Islamic in their kind of tendencies or points of view, folks like Mos Def, Talib Kweli, Lupe Fiasco more recently, they're looking at, all right, how can we live this faith? We've seen from the schoolhouse to the courthouse to the White House, to the church house, too much corruption, scandal, you know, human frailty and failure, and lack of accountability. For this generation, the hip-hop generation, how can we claim something that's true and real in this world, right? For those of you, once again, who are enrolled in the class and had a chance to listen to the full playlist, I've offered some other songs, some songs that aren't derived or based within a African-American Muslim idiom, you know, such as Lauryn Hill's To Zion, or most notably Kanye West's song, Jesus Walk. I'm talking about in using those songs in the larger scheme of things to try and look at how, and I'm glad to discuss this shortly, but looking at these songs and how, due to the space that has been created by the larger trajectory of hip-hop as it moved through these three kind of iterations, religion as ideological, religion as instrumental, and finally religion as integral, you now had a greater space, a greater opportunity for Christian-centric or Christian-themed hip-hop that could actually hold its own weight, both in terms of song quality as well as street credibility with these Black Muslim inspired or influenced songs. Also, and I'll end on this note, rather than having to take the marginal or outsider perspective in being able to launch critiques about society in general or matters of faith in particular, focusing on the Christian experience, now you had folks from within the culture, within the faith, who could now speak more plainly, more clearly about what they found wrong with the church, or what they were concerned about in matters of life and death, matters of body and soul. So what I want to do now and turn this from a soliloquy to hopefully a symphony is open up some time for y'all to give me some feedback or have some exchange. So I want to thank you, and I look forward to comments and conversation. Please, that's fine.
On page 60 of your article, you discuss how women are attracted to the five percenters.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fascinated by why. I mean, and you mentioned a little bit about how those who haven't read the article don't have it, that they appreciate the strength of the men and mm-hmm. the protective posture toward them.
Mm-hmm.
in a society that either denigrates or ignores black femininity. I was just fascinated, though, that why they would be attracted to something, whereas they can never reach a full number seven,
mm-hmm.
which is the perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Women in this 5 percenter can only ever reach a six.
Mm-hmm.
What are your kind of further thoughts on that?
Okay. Well, I appreciate the question. And what I would directly assert is, unfortunately, even though it's most easily and readily exemplified in the confines of the 5 percenter nation, the idea that that kind of sexism or that kind of glass ceiling isn't specific to the 5 percenter nation as a whole. You know, say what you will about the recent turn of events in American politics, we noticed that in attaining the highest office in the land, there are several barriers, some racial, some gender, some class, some faith-based. But going further and thinking about that specific issue, one book that automatically pops to mind, Carolyn Rouse, Engage Surrender. Now, she's looking specifically at African-American Sunni Muslim women, you know, the more orthodox Muslim tradition. But what she found, and I think this has some resonance with the question that you're asking, is that can women, given a choice of diminishing expectations or opportunities, choose to sacrifice or surrender some privileges, some rights, some access and opportunity for perceived advantages, not real advantages, and certainly not privileges, but within the confines of a societal situation where you don't find, as the sociologist William Julius Wilson would refer to as the marriageable male index, where within the black community, not being able to find suitable life partners. So now, setting your sights on men who are striving, are ambitious, are courteous and disciplined, and this is the compromise I have to make in order to enter into what I see as a somewhat satisfying intimate relationship or committed partnership. My faith, and you know, folks in many faith traditions and denominations might wrestle with this, wherein women most frequently, you know, support the faith community with their time, their tithe, their effort, their ministry, but because of the doctrine, because of the stinking thinking that's pervaded that tradition for so long, and the notion that if it's broke, don't fix it, just allowing the idea that women could be kept to the margin. And then last but not least, and I think that this is something very crucial within the issue of how hip-hop in general, but especially this Muslim-inspired hip-hop, has to deal with gender and sexuality, is that the lack of a viable feminist or womanist kind of perspective within the realm of hip-hop has become so death-dealing that I can actually, in several cases, engage young female students who are within the hip-hop generation and listen to the music, not even making any kind of faith decisions. But they say that, you know, they don't listen to the lyrics, they only move to the beat. They, you know, it becomes a neck-down experience. And saying that if they want to socialize, if they want to inhabit the spheres and the spaces in which their, you know, potential dating partners or their friends and, you know, loved ones inhabit and entertain and enjoy themselves, that they have to live a neck down rather than a neck up experience. To me, that's devastating. But what happens, and I wanted to interject this very quickly, the song with Erykah Badu and Busta Rhymes, One, it tries to talk about this idea of becoming just one, that two become one, very familiar concept, and they form a family. Now, what becomes fascinating about this at the end of the song is that both interlocutors, Busta Rhymes as the male figure and Erykah Badu with all her you know, independent woman and free-willed, spirited kind of passion, they're coming at each other, but like ships in the night. They're having a conversation about what they think is an ideal relationship, but they're just passing each other by. You know, he's talking about, oh, you know, you're going to support me, shorty. You're going to hold me down. And then she's saying that, well, you know, I want a man who doesn't see my ambition as competition. And he never responds to that. They just keep going. So what I would think, or what I would try to have people engage, is this idea that women, as well as men, gravitate to a faith, gravitate to certain traditions and practices because of how they think it will make them feel, or how it will validate and affirm their already in place beliefs or concerns. Once again, going to that Tillichian notion of ultimacy. So if all you want is a stable, loving, kind of affirming context, whether it be a romantic relationship on this horizontal plane, or whether it's this notion of verticality, that I see God only as a strong figure that's going to, you know, just handle me, but not necessarily, you know. So wrestling with this notion that you don't want or don't gravitate towards a God of love and mercy, but you need a God of law and order, putting it in those kind of terms. Suddenly, this tells us a lot more about, okay, where are these people coming from? What are their concerns? And how can we best relate to what's going on in their situation? Yes?
I'm curious, this kind of has to do with liberation. If you juxtaposing, I guess, the late 80s and the late 90s, so you've got like Public Enemy and in the 80s and then like Raucous and Lyricist Brown stuff, mm-hmm. like as a resurgence of what we're calling conscious kind of rap. And mm-hmm. there's a disconnect though between what we're kind of in a sense praising tonight with regards to like what was happening as far as the social movement and conscientization, but the fact is, like many, many young black youth don't listen to the same kind of stuff. I mean, like, they have Lil Wayne in their CD players as opposed to Talib Kweli. So, I guess, I can't speak to the Public Enemy era, but like with Lyricist Lounge, you have people who, I know Kweli's parents were like college educated, one's a professor, mm-hmm. common, similar situation and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So, I mean, it seems like there's an educational, elitism or whatever mm-hmm. that kind of works, which allows for this like beautiful musical experience. But there's, I mean, how can it get delivered? I mean, our best answer, it seems, today is Kanye West, which is just kind of strange. So, why is there that disconnect, and what do we do about it? Because, I mean, like, mm-hmm. For instance, when I was working in a church, I mean, no kids, they had heard of KRS-One, but they'd mm-hmm. never heard of him. What's the name of that song? You Must Learn.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, about, and how, like, reappropriating or the Bible and, mm-hmm. and putting it in its proper black context, mm-hmm. That just so, like, what?
Okay. Well, once again, it's easy to scapegoat or throw a lot of the societal ills and woes on black cultural productions or kind of black experiences, but you know, we can go back to the historian Richard Hofstadter's, you know, anti-intellectualism, work on anti-intellectualism in American life, and know that, you know, being adverse to reading or education isn't just a immediate phenomenon. Unfortunately, it's a national catastrophe, as anybody who's been around for the last decade might know. But the idea and the concern that what we're wrestling with here has a lot to do with notions of education or enlightenment, and it doesn't necessarily fall strictly on the side of, you know, formal or traditional education, although places like Vanderbilt wouldn't exist if we didn't march onto that higher calling. But the notion, you know, I'm borrowing from Antonio Gramsci about the notion of having traditional intellectuals, but then also having organic intellectuals, right? Folks who, if they don't have the opportunity to invest in a more formal or traditional mode of learning, but they're still seeking knowledge, still trying to produce and you know, engage in the learning process, right? Do they have a place in our society, right? Taking this one step further, and once again, not trying to extol that, oh, well, all you need to do is buy a Kanye West or Mos Def CD and you have all the education you'll need for a year. I'm not saying that. What I'm trying to suggest, however, is this idea that there are some insights, there are some perspectives that we can only get from the experiences of those who are going through them and living through certain conditions or certain circumstances. So to use Mos Def as an example, he's what Cornel West would affectionately refer to as a prophetic Muslim brother who, you know, is a Sunni Muslim. He's wrestling with, all right, how do you live in this society, especially in the post-September 11th world, have this faith, have this shade of skin, operate with this kind of politic that's committed to social justice, but then also still be a red-blooded American male, still be a father, still be, you know, a business partner to and a friend to other people. How do you live life in its fullest perspective, right? So, for instance, in his song, the one that was on the playlist, Fear Not of Man, right, he offers just a very simple kind of suggestion that, you know, folks are always wondering, how will people get better? Well, people won't get better until they know that they're created by God and have value, and that in that value, it's more than money, it's more than, you know, people thinking you're sexy or what have you. It's about, can you esteem yourself and the God in you, right? He doesn't have control of anybody's pulpit on Sunday morning, but that's a message that Christians as well as non-Christians need to hear, right? That's a form of education, small e, not capital E, that I think can, you know, resonate with many people who find in their everyday lives nothing but a crisis. Right, last but not least, and I'll entertain any other comment or question y'all have, Kanye West, in and of himself, just a very divided man. Right? On this album, you know, his first album, The College Dropout, you have on the one hand someone who, you know, his mother, as you suggested, was a doctor. His late mother was a college professor at all. His father was a Black Panther, if I'm not mistaken. Right, so he came from a family that was politically as well as intellectually engaged, and yet he washed out of college. And that's fine. It seems that he's gone on to some other success in life. All right, okay. But yet and again, right, you know, he has a strong political point of view. He has, you know, in some cases, you know, very eclectic but very progressive kind of sensibilities, but then on the other hand, strongly anti-intellectual. And yet, as a kind of role model, whether by choice or by force, what kind of message does he send to a large swath of African-American youth who they think that the only way that they can get out of the bad life chances they have is either through hip-hop or, you know, crack rock or, you know, jump shots? Yes.
Well, I wonder if you might just speak briefly about are there any studies, ethnographic studies, for instance, one of the things that we're looking at are fandoms, you know, mm-hmm. you know, fan cultures, yeah. And so on. Are there any ethnographic studies of hip hop fan cultures? The sort of users of the music and mm-hmm. how, in what ways those cultures work, but also multiple uses, perhaps, of this music.
Okay.
I didn't know if there was any research that I
would. Well, I would just throw this into consideration that, on the whole, scholarly or academic works of that sort, ethnographic investigations, are still in the making. You may be able to find some dissertations or the like, but one interesting work that's done on a popular basis, bless you, a fellow by the name of Bakari Kitwana, who as I hear, he recently made a visit here to Vandy not so long ago. He's written a book, quite simply, Why Kids Love Hip Hop.
Right.
Okay, that, even though, like I said, it doesn't match the kind of rigor or serious kind of scrutiny that you would hope in a social scientific study. I think that it's one of the closest attempts that we've seen recently of folks trying to get inside the heads of the fan base, of fandom, and trying to figure out, okay, why are hip-hop lovers still coming back to the music? And especially for the issue of saying, all right, is there a component about this where, as I'll attempt to discuss, is there a component of the music where for folks within the kind of context of the worlds or spheres in which hip-hop is generated, are you looking for an escape, a way out? Or for folks who are on the periphery of you know, the ghetto, the hood, whatever, are you looking for a way in? Are you looking for a means of vicarious living? Are you looking for a means of titillation and interrogation of a world that you don't know, but you just want to be kind of a day tripper in? So I think that's one book I would gladly recommend. No problem.
We've got about 5 more minutes. Any other?
Please.
I thought about the one suggested paradigm for thinking about art in general is, and it's full of problems, but high art, folk art, and popular art.
Sure.
And so one thing I wonder, because I really did notice that shift, I guess it was in the late 90s, even after gangster rap, you started, all of a sudden everybody on the rap videos was wearing like kind of shiny metallic pants, and it was the kind of Mace, P. Diddy, which we're still kind of in, and then sort of neo-soul movement over against.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that is something that happens to folk art in a capitalist country, because at some point it catches on. You know, the organic, whatever, the banjo music of the Appalachians catches on. And then inevitably you start distilling it to just, I need to sell units. And I don't know if that's an oversimplification, but I still really struggle with that issue of how in the world did that happen? Because I feel like when I was a kid, songs were really long and complex and lyric heavy, and now I'm like, I don't know what that's.
Okay. Well, I think you're right on target here, and let me try to nail this in a couple of quick ways. First, the demands of market versus, to borrow the kind of concern that I wanted to preface the class with, in terms of the roots, one of my most favorite hip-hop groups of all time, they've constantly, throughout their career, battled with the struggle between art and commerce, between keeping the soul of the music, and I don't use that word loosely, versus conforming and serving the demands of the marketplace. Now, one of the things that we always have to wrestle with, even in the era of shiny suits and, you know, all that and simple lyrics, was the issue of whether conformity could be confused with community, whether ubiquity was automatically a sense of unity. And I'm saying this in terms of, you know, a group like the Roots, that they become the go-to band as far as anybody who ever wanted to have some live, original, organic music within the realm of R&B and hip-hop today. Erykah Badu, even Al Green recently has worked with members of the Roots, right, seeking to somehow get back to, quite literally, the roots of culture. That's where they derive their name from. Well, what happens when they could be seen as, you know, great initiators and innovators on that level, but not musically viable? You know, most kids, especially under the age of 16 or 17, wouldn't go near a Roots CD if you forced it on them, taped like $50 bills to it. But it's good music. So do we have a space and a place for folks who are willing to, you know, chart their own course and beat their own path, or does the market ultimately win? Do the dictates of the market forces ultimately say, you know, what qualifies as quote-unquote good music. Something else just to tack on to this. Throughout at least the 20th century and maybe even earlier, the notion that quote-unquote folk art or low art has often been co-opted and brought into high art status. So we can think of, you know, I think in easier terms, jazz, right? When you heard it originate in the streets of New Orleans and then ultimately make its way up the Mississippi to places like Chicago and elsewhere, the most condescending and derogatory critics called it, you know, jungle music. That, you know, Theodore Adorno, one of the members of the Frankfurt School, you know, high cultural critic that he was, just called it noise, right? But shortly thereafter, after it got rehabilitated, suddenly instead of, you know, folks in, you know, common everyday rags and clothes, you had folks wearing tuxedos and evening gowns who were not only performing the music but listening to the music. Suddenly, it's America's contribution to the world, right? So what happens writ large when that's the case? You know, right here in Nashville, you think about the origins of the Fisk Jubilee Singers, who, you know, in order to finance that fine institution not so far from here, right, they had to go on tour not only here in the U.S. but throughout Europe. And from the proceeds of their concerts where they had to sing old spirituals, right, they had to make enough money to build buildings and supply bread and meat for their classmates back on campus, right? And then suddenly, Europe became ignited with a passion to hear the old-timey, you know, music coming from the Negro church. So, and then once that validation came, suddenly in America, oh, well, you know, those spirituals, there's something to them. Then suddenly we could have, you know, song catchers and folks like Alan Lomax, you know, walking, you know, here and there across the southern countryside recording this music now. And thankfully we have some version of it recorded. But, you know, the constraints of high and low culture are very elastic at best, but they always skew to the side of folks who have privilege and power.
Thanks so much.
Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We really hate to finish so early, but I'd love to carry on and keep this discussion going, but because it's just been tremendous. But we do have an extremely important national and cultural event.
I heard something else was going on.
About
yeah.
to happen, and I really don't want this event to get in the way of your participation in that. So. My class, we'll see you next week. Is that right? Yes, mm-hmm. Next week. All right, next Tuesday night. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you, man. Oh, I appreciate it.
This is a stunt.